1 hour down and it went quickly. My goodness. There's just so much happening in October that I have to kind of throw out the window this promise that we will get to absolutely everything because it just doesn't happen. But we're going to do as much as we possibly can. And to that end, talking about not just what happened in week 5 in the NFL, going all the way back to a game in London that kicked off at 9:30 Eastern time, which is 6:30 for those of you who are listening right now on the West Coast. And we're going to get to Niners and Cardinals and Seahawks as well. So there's a lot to do. Gosh, that we were talking about the Rams, right? A lot to do. So yes, we're going to talk LA here coming up. And I dare say that it's a night in which sports fans are looking to LeBron and Bronny and saying, help us, help us. Though all hope is not lost for the Dodgers, but the pitching's pretty rough. So now Michael Duarte of NBC LA is joining us. This was kind of a rough night for the Dodgers, but I want to start with fans throwing stuff on the field. Dave Roberts says he's never seen anything like that before. What's your experience in LA?
Yeah, it was a great segue as far as the bad stuff goes. Dave Roberts said, I was in that press conference room after the game, that he'd been to over 1,000 Dodger games, obviously as a coach for 9 seasons, as a player before that. He'd never seen anything like that. I've never seen anything like it as far as the 2 to 3 dozen security cards that came on the field, the nearly 10-minute delay for everything in the middle of a playoff game right after the 7th-inning stretch. But I have seen, we can go all the way back, Amy, to the Barry Bonds era, with fans throwing inflatable steroid pills at Bonds. And this has kind of been a thing with rivals and Dodger fans for years. And it goes to the other team's fans as well, the opposing team's fans, whether it's the Giants or, in this case, the Padres. When a rivalry is this intense, when it's the postseason and emotions are high and liquor is flowing in this stadium, something as playful and innocent as a home run robbery by Jerks and Profar in the bottom of the first inning that would have tied the game, and some jawing back and forth from between fans, can kind of, it's like a ticking time bomb, that as that jawing continues and the making fun and throwing balls into the crowd and vice versa begins to go, and then the game begins to kind of get out of reach, and now your team is losing and the other team is taunting and provoking, then it's like lighting that fuse, lighting that match, and this thing can explode. And I think that's what we saw happen in the 7th inning at Chavez Ravine on Sunday night.
I know that as drama goes and fun storylines and just great back and forth, it's nice to have two teams who know each other well. That whole, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. And these two teams are both so familiar. The fan bases are so intertwined there. However, I'm wondering, and this is just your opinion, of course, Michael, from the Dodgers' perspective, do you think they would have preferred to see anybody else except for the Padres, considering how well San Diego played against them this year?
I mean, if I talk to the players, say Oscar Hernandez is one guy that said this was the team he wanted. Miguel Rojas told me he wanted the Padres too. Ah. I think. Look, if you're looking at it purely from a on paper perspective, no, not necessarily. But this is baseball. You know, I was just joking with friends today. 2 years ago in 2022, I thought there was no way the Padres would get past the Mets in the wild card when they were throwing Jacob DeGrom and Scherzer out there in those first two games. But yet they survived that and then stunned the 111-win Dodgers. And now we're looking for a setup like where it could be the exact same thing. It could be deja vu here again in 2024. The Dodgers, if you recall, won the first game of that series and then lost the next three, including getting swept the two games at Petco Park. And if you're looking at it on paper, the pitching matches with Michael King and Walker Buehler in Game 3 and then probably two bullpen games in Game 4, it could potentially be setting up for a similar situation here this year. So yes, especially with a lot of baseball analysts predicting that the Padres were the most well-balanced team. I also think the Padres are the most well-balanced team, top to bottom with the lineup. They have guys who can hit for average. They have guys that can slug and power from both sides of the plate, as you saw tonight with the 6 home runs, which, by the way, Amy, that is the most the Dodgers have allowed in a playoff game in franchise history. And that goes all the way back to the 1880s when they were the Brooklyn Bridegrooms. So 6 home runs in a playoff game.
Sorry.
The most all time for the Dodgers. And this team could also hit for average with Luis Arias, obviously, the batting champion. Jerks and Profar, another guy. The bullpen is amazing. The defense, as you saw today, was on full display for the Padres, robbing home runs, diving catches, leaping catches. Anytime the Dodgers thought they had maybe a rally going, it was snuffed out by that Padres' excellent defense. So top to bottom, I think they're the most well-balanced team right now, still in the tournament. And that's why a lot of people predicted that they could go to the World Series this year. And I'm on that same exact train. But the last thing I'll say to your question, I think tonight's game in Game 2 played perfectly into the Padres' script. Guys like Manny Machado, Fernando Tatis Jr., Profar, obviously what you saw in the beginning, they want to be the villain. Manny Machado went out there and gambled his entire $300 million contract that the Padres would win the World Series before the Dodgers when he switched from blue to brown in 2019. Obviously, he lost that gamble. But he's been a provoker for years of the Dodgers fan base. Just there during this last homestand when the Padres turned that triple play started by him to win and clinch a postseason berth, he said after the game he was surprised that Dodgers fans didn't leave early, and then he said their probation must have been extended. So he's an instigator in all of this. Tatis is an instigator in all this. There's videos, if you look on social media tonight, of him thrusting his pelvic at them and gyrating and doing the fake tears, and he's an instigator in all this. They want the villain. They want all the smoke and the heat. They kind of want these things thrown at them. Fans should never do that. You should never throw anything at the players. This is not the Malice at the Palace, but they want all that negative attention. They're feeding off of it, and I think it played right into it. The Dodgers fans played right into it tonight. And the last thing I'll say about it, too, is this all started, and really that fuse got lit when Jack Flaherty hit Fernando Tatis to start off the fourth inning. Manny Machado started jawing at him. He then struck out Manny Machado, and then Jack Flaherty gave it back to him, told him to go sit down with an expletive. After that, they were jawing at each other, and Manny Machado threw a baseball at the Dodgers' dugout. That pissed off all the guys in the dugout. That got Flaherty on the top step, telling him he would fight him and they should go meet out back after the game. That really kind of ignited men. This. And I think exactly. Men, testosterone, emotions, playoff baseball. I really think the Dodgers might have poked the bear here in the Padres because they didn't play like this in Game 1, and now they got all the momentum going to Game 3.
Michael Duarte is with us after that game at Chavez Ravine where the Padres take it on the back of 6 home runs and a lot of jawing, a lot of fireworks. And now the series is tied as they head to San Diego for Game 3. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. What's the status of Freddie Freeman?
Yeah, you asked the same thing. I know essentially as much as you do, but I do have the behind the scenes of seeing him prepare for the last few days for this series. I mean, he's been shot up. He's very medicated. But every day, whether it was the workout on Friday or Thursday, where I saw him running sprints, testing it, running from first to third, doing it again before the game on Saturday before Game 1, everything seemed pretty positive. Like he was going to be able to play through the pain and give it a go. And then he tried to play possum and steal a base, which he successfully did in Game 1, Amy. But if you watch the replay, that wasn't much of a slide. It was a collision with the base. It's his right ankle that he has that high ankle sprain on, and that got caught in the bag on it. I think that re-aggravated the injury a little bit, probably caused some more pain. He tried to play through it tonight. He couldn't do it. And what I would say is telling, Amy, is when he came out in that sixth inning, he was due up third in the bottom half of the inning, meaning he could have tried to push through and at least go to the plate in the bottom half of the inning and then maybe come out knowing maybe that's his last at-bat of the night. And he didn't do it. And that tells me something about Freddie Freeman really having to have a lot of pain on that ankle because this guy's played through a broken finger this season, and to come out like that is frustrating. Now, the good news is you have an off day in between, so he can get treatment all day tomorrow, doesn't have to put weight on it, can do what they call rice, you know, rest, elevate, ice, heat, whatever he can, and see how he feels before the game on Tuesday. But that's not a good sign yet to come out, and it could be a bad sign for the Dodgers here moving forward.
The Dodgers pitching has been their weakness all season long. That rotation has gone through, I don't know how many iterations, it feels like dozens of them. Jack Flaherty, he gets hit pretty hard, but it's not just him, it's the bullpen too. How does the pitching stack up now, starting with Game 3?
Yeah, I mean, the Dodgers have actually had 20 different starting pitchers this season. That is just mind-blowing when a normal starting rotation is 5, but 20 this year. How does it stack up behind Flaherty? Look, this Dodgers team knew that their strong suit would be the bullpen, They don't necessarily have three all-star guys in the back end of the pen like the Padres do, but they got five or six really solid guys, high leverage guys, guys that they trust, guys that can go left on left matchups, like Alex Vesia. They got guys who can throw 100 miles per hour, like their new incumbent closer who they acquired at the deadline from the White Sox and Michael Kopech. They got Blake Treinen, who you saw come out and do a five-out save. Daniel Hudson, their closer, who was the closer all of last season and the first half of the season, and Evan Phillips, who has a nasty sweeper slider. They got a lot of different looks, pitches, and things they can throw, and they just want to get through four or five innings through their starters, hopefully scoreless, or at least, you know, unscathed that much, one run at best, and then get to the pen and throw out all these weapons at them. The good news for the Dodgers is they didn't really use any of the guys except for Ryan Brazier, that they used in Game 1. So all these guys are going to have some extra rest now to be ready to go for Games 3 and 4 if they're called upon, which I think they will be. And the guys, this game got out of hand late, but it was guys like Michael Grove, Enriquez, which these are guys you're not going to see through the postseason. These are guys who were literally on the playoff roster for mop-up duty. And so the high-leverage arms will be ready to go in Game 3. They need Walker Buehler to turn back the clock, Amy, to look like that 2018, 19, even should I say 20 and 21 Walker Buehler, that was probably their best big game pitcher. Mm-hmm. They need him to come out. I know he can't throw 100 miles per hour anymore coming off of two Tommy John surgeries, but the last time he took the mound for the Dodgers was in that crucial game against the Padres where they needed to clinch the NL West. He went out there and gave a great performance. He needs to do that again. They don't need him to go deep. Like Darvish went seven today. They don't need him to do that. In fact, the last quality start by a Dodgers starter in the postseason was Max Scherzer in the 2021 wild card game against the Cardinals, if you can believe that, Amy. They just don't let the pitchers go that deep anymore. So right. If Walker Buehler can give them five, that's exactly what they need. And if he can keep them close with Michael King, who's been excellent for the Padres this year in his first year as a starter, then I think that bodes well if it goes the bullpen to bullpen and the Dodgers have a lead or close. I think it bodes well for them and plays into their playbook and their strong suit if that was the case in Game 3.
Michael, just a few seconds before we pivot a little bit to football, but going back to Saturday night, Shohei Ohtani blasts his first career postseason home run. We've waited 10 years, not quite 10, we've waited 8 years to see him on this stage, and he comes through with that huge moment that ties the game and, of course, propels the Dodgers to the opening win. What was that like inside Dodger Stadium?
Oh, my gosh, Amy. It's like, first of all, Shohei Ohtani in the playoffs is like this library book that's been sitting on my desk for years. It's long overdue. I am so glad we finally get to see the best player in baseball in the postseason.
Only you, Michael. Only you.
Thank you. Thank you. And what I want to say is I read a stat the other day. The Dodgers were like 0-for-20 when down by three runs or more after the first inning. They'd never been able to come back and win a game. But, of course, they never had Shohei Ohtani. And I think for Dodgers fans, going down 3-0 early after that two-run home run by Manny Machado on Yamamoto in the first inning, we're hearing that maybe he was tipping his pitches, and that is out there. But Ohtani erases it all with one swing in the bottom of the second, pronounces himself on the October stage, and essentially, as I wrote in my Game 1 story, does what he's been doing all year long, and that is be the superstar, be the hero. He loves those dramatic moments. We saw it in the World Baseball Classic when he won for Team Japan, the Samurai, striking out Mike Trout. He lives for these moments. He's not intimidated by him. He's not nervous, as he said in his pregame press conference. And I watched him when he stepped into the box for his very first at-bat in the bottom of the first inning. He looked calm as a cucumber. There are very few guys who can just lower the temperature, lower the heart rate, and just be completely cool as a polar bear when they step into those high-pressure moments. Ohtani is one of them, and I'm just so glad we finally get to see it. On the flip side, though, on the counter side, Amy, Yu Darvish threw him nothing but breaking balls, off-speed stuff, curveballs, sliders today. Not until that third at-bat could even throw a single pitch over 89 miles per hour. He might have created the formula for how to get Ohtani out moving forward in this postseason.
All right, we'll see with Game 3 to come on Tuesday in San Diego. Are you headed to San Diego for the game?
I am. I'll be leaving tomorrow. I'll be out there for Games 3 and 4.
Cool.
And hopefully we'll come back to Dodger Stadium for Game 5 next Friday. Or I'll be back at Dodger Stadium next March when they open it up for opening day against the Tigers. So we'll see.
That's how drastically it can change all those postseason plans, not just for you, but for the team. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence, Michael Duarte. A couple more minutes here just to talk about the Rams. Major turning point in their game against the Packers happens early in the second half where they've got the back-to-back turnovers. And, of course, the Packers were able to score those two Tucker Kraft touchdowns. And I know they made it close late, because that's what Matthew Stafford does. But how much are they missing their top receivers in Kupp and Nacua?
Yeah, I mean, we're like Ross from Friends. We're able to pivot, and I like it. the question that you have is, and I'm going to go back to what we talked about, where maybe this is deja vu for the Dodgers in 2022 in the NLDS. This is starting to look like the Rams 2022 post-Super Bowl season, where the wheels fell off and they went 5-12, the worst season for a Super Bowl champ the following year in NFL history. And it was all due to injuries. If you recall that year, they lost Stafford, they lost Kupp, they lost Aaron Donald, they lost their entire offensive line. And it's starting to feel eerily reminiscent here again. What I saw for most of the game, and you can look at, you know, they're having red zone troubles. They had it last week against the Bears in that loss. They had it on that opening drive, where they had a turnover on downs when they had the ball first and goal from the four. That was a big issue. Turnovers was an issue. Obviously, have the Kyren Williams fumble that you mentioned, and then the interception on back-to-back drives that led to the two touchdowns for the Packers. And even though Jordan Love gifted them that pick six at the end of the first half, the first lead, by the way, Amy, the Rams have had in the first half all season, whoa, although they squandered it. But looking at those plays that led to the interception, the fumble, the offensive line is just not protecting and keeping Matthew Stafford up as he needs to be. And when he doesn't have the trust in his receivers, even though guys like Jordan Whittington have stepped up, guys like Tutu Atwell have stepped up, it's not Cooper Kupp. It's not Puka Nacua, as you mentioned, guys he's developed this unbelievable chemistry and trust with. And if you need evidence of that, look no further to that Super Bowl in February of 2022 at SoFi Stadium against the Bengals after Odell Beckham Jr. goes out with an ACL injury. And Bengals are triple-teaming Cooper Kupp, knowing he's the only receiver the Rams have. And Matthew Stafford's out there throwing no-look passes to him. And when the game was on the line, who'd he give the ball to? Cooper Kupp. So he definitely misses this guy. The Rams' offense misses this guy. Thankfully, they go into bye week next week. I know they're 1-4. I know things look dire. But if Cooper can come back for that Raiders game, which I believe is the next home game after the bye week, if Puka Nacua can come back, if some of the offensive linemen that are out can come back and keep Matthew Stafford upright, things can turn around quickly. Remember, this Rams team was 3-6 after week 10 last year, and they came back and won 7 of 8 and made the postseason. And we're very close, maybe a pass interference on Puka Nacua away from beating the Lions in that wild card round. So if they can get healthy, they can get hot. They still have a shot, but the wheels can also come off very quickly for the Rams.
Well, before I let you go, though, I want to focus on something you just said about keeping Stafford upright. The guy's 36 years old. I know he's really tough. At times, I feel like he's a superhero out there. The number of hits he takes, and he just keeps on playing. But, man, I mean, they've got to give him some kind of time or keep him from getting hit as often as he is. 3 official sacks, but what, another, like, dozen QB hits in this game? That's a lot for him.
Correct, yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, 3 sacks this week, 3 sacks last week, and I think 5 against the Cardinals the week before. But he's getting knocked down. I'm literally watching him pick himself up off the ground after every passing play. So he's not getting sacked, but he's hitting the turf a lot. And this is a guy who we know is durable. He plays through injuries. But as we saw last week, with the last year when they played the Packers, he missed that game with a finger injury. If he goes out, then it's just complete disaster for the Rams. Now, I know they have Jimmy Garoppolo to back him up. He's a veteran. That's why they went out and got him. But they need to keep him healthy. They need to keep him upright. And they need to get those offensive weapons back ASAP, or they can be in very big, big trouble.
Great stuff on Mike's Twix. At Michael J. Duarte from what is the Dodgers clubhouse, but also Padres talking about what was a very spirited game too that featured plenty of jawing, plenty of extracurricular activity, some fans who forced a delay out there in left field. But it's cool to see these two go toe to toe and the Padres certainly not backing down. So again, find him online at Michael J. Duarte. I feel like normally we talk to you after there's something positive positive. In this case, it's negative for LA sports fans. But you know what? You wait 24 hours, everything changes again. That's kind of how sports is.
That's definitely how the news cycle works, but something positive. We got to see history with LeBron James and Bronny James on the same court tonight. I know it was a preseason game, but it still is the first time that's ever happened. That's got to be a proud moment. And, you know, once this October baseball is over, we're going to get looking forward to watching Bronny and LeBron play on the court together in a regular season game. And that's going to be really exciting and really fun to watch.
All right, we'll talk then. Yeah, no doubt. That'll be some really sweet history with the entire world paying attention. Thanks so much, Mike, for a couple of minutes. It's good to catch up with you always.
Always good for you, too, and watching all your feeds and the flowers and everything. So keep it up and have a great show, and we'll talk soon.
Yes, October, nutso. But Mike is great, and I feel badly because we're mostly talking about negative stuff for L.A., but he's awesome, and there was a lot happening on Saturday and Sunday for both the Dodgers and Padres, so you get the Padres side of it as well, Rams and Packers, which we'll get to from Green Bay's perspective, straight ahead, Cardinals and Niners in that same NFC West division, and what an upset. Could this be the best victory for Arizona since Jonathan Gannon took over? We'll talk about that next at A-Law Radio, our Facebook page as well. I shared a new quote from Mike Tomlin. If I didn't tell you it was Mike Tomlin, you might still know it was Mike Tomlin. In fact, maybe I'll, for people who are joining us a little bit later in the show, take his name off of the post on Facebook and see if you all can figure out who it is. Glad to have you with us. Thanks for hanging. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence.
Midfield. Cardinals moving right to left. And the snap to Murray, and he's going to keep it running to the right. He's got room at the 45-40. He points to the sky as he takes off at the 30, at the 20, the 10, the 5, touchdown. A design run for Kyler Murray. It goes for 50 yards. He's barking at the crowd in the end zone.
First and goal, 5-yard line. Niners looking for the end zone in the lead. They go empty here. Saubert is right, 3 yard left, including Ayuk out left. Throw over the middle, and it's caught by George Kittle. Touchdown, San Francisco!
Off the field, on the money, and after hours, it's time to talk football with Amy Lawrence.
Back to the NFL in week 5, and some stunners around the league, including in the NFC West, Kyler Murray with a 50-yard touchdown run. And that was early on in this game, but there was a lot more to come before the Cardinals would end up with their one-point victory. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Of course, the San Francisco 49ers, they're home, they're able to answer, and they go on a tear following that Kyler TD. 3 scoring drives in a row, and just for good measure, a little help on special teams.
45-yard field goal here for Chad Ryland trying to tie the game. Made a 30-yarder earlier. Left hash mark. Gillikin will hold. Snap. Or block! And then scoop back the other way and running back the other way. D'Amador Lenore. Touchdown! San Francisco!
That's Greg Papa on the Niners radio network. So yeah, they're not only able to put points on the board offensively, but also a block field goal that goes 61 yards for that score by D'Amador Lenore, who's got one of my favorite names in the NFL. So I like to say the whole thing all the time. D'Amador Lenore. Oh, but I'm not supposed to get it wrong. D'Amador Lenore. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. So Kyler then throws another interception, and that adds a field goal for the Niners, and they're sitting pretty. They're up at the half by multiple scores, but then the wheels come off for the Niners, and it's a really messy second half. So there's a Brock Purdy ball that gets tipped for an interception by Mack Wilson. That leads to an Arizona field goal, and then a red zone trip for the Niners that ends on a failed fourth down. And you can see it here where the Cardinals believe they've got some hope. They've got the ball. They go on a 12-play march for 6.5 minutes and a real good mix between Kyler throwing, Kyler handing off, working a lot of different guys into the equation.
Kyler Murray under center, Higgins in front of Connor in an I formation. Now they shift. And in the shotgun is Murray on first and goal. Snap to Murray. It's a quarterback run to the left. Now he backs up and throws left side back of the end zone. Higgins got both feet down, made the catch. It's a touchdown.
Dave Pasch with the calls on the Cardinals radio network. So, yeah, they weren't quite done there. They get the two-point conversion. James Conner, another real big game for him. Now, Jordan Mason, who's filled in really well for Christian McCaffrey. I know there isn't anyone out there who's quite as versatile and productive as CMC, but Jordan Mason's done well. He's had multiple 100-yard rushing games, but he gets into the red zone middle of the fourth quarter, and he fumbles the ball away. So Arizona gets that ball back. Now, they've got to go quite a long distance the other direction, but they're able to run the clock, and of course, at this point, they're going to be uber aggressive, even on fourth down.
Murray in the gun. Three receivers left, one right. Fourth and five on the Arizona 40. Down 23-21. Murray waiting. Takes the snap. Five-step deep drop. Pressure on his face. Lobs the ball near side. Coming back to make the catch. In San Francisco territory is Harrison at the 48 for a first down. 35-yard field goal try from Chad Ryland. Ball on the far hash mark. Cardinals down two. This would give Arizona the lead. 1:40 to go in the game. Gillikin to hold. Snap is high. He got it down. The kick is on the way, and the kick is good. And the Cardinals have the lead, 24-23. 1:37 to go in the game.
Wow, talk about stunning. And then with just those 90 seconds left, Brock Purdy throws his second interception and the Cardinals defense is able to seal that win. So with three turnovers by the Niners, this is a little bit like what we saw with the Dallas Cowboys on Sunday night. Now, the Cowboys were able to get that late scoring drive, and with 20 seconds to go, they do, in fact, come away with the winning touchdown. But had they lost that game, we'd be pointing to missed opportunities, wasted possessions, and turnovers. And that's what happened with the Niners. They've squandered now a second double-digit lead when it felt like they, and this is in division, right, where they're now 0-2 in the NFC West, where it felt like this was worse than just a loss because they were so vulnerable after posting that lead.
Extremely frustrated. I think we had 13 points and 17 in the other. By no means should we be able to give that away. Always will come back to turnovers, in my opinion. There's other things you can do to overcome them. Talked about last night how we thought a key in this game would be turnovers, and that's exactly what the first half was. Gave us a huge advantage, and then it flipped in the second half, and when you do that, it's tough to win.
Down at half, still felt really good about what we were doing. Had a couple plays go against us there, you know, with the block kick for a touchdown and the interception. Game kind of swung in their favor. You know, but we battled, man. They were convicted at halftime. We talked about it all week, what kind of game it was going to be. We wanted to get to the fourth quarter and have a chance to win the game, and that's what we did.
So, yeah, for the Niners, this is not quite the same team that we have seen in the past. But still, to be this vulnerable has got to be frustrating, and that's the word that Kyle Shanahan uses. But for Jonathan Gannon to be able to have all 14 points for the Cardinals in the second half. So the Niners don't score once they get into the second half. Instead, the Cardinals able to take advantage of those mistakes by the Niners and not just take the ball away from San Francisco, but use them as opportunities. That's part of growing a winning culture. And to get this victory, it speaks volumes of where they can go. Of course, where they want to go is where the Niners are. That's where everybody wants to be in the NFC West, is where the Niners have been with these Super Bowl appearances lately. And the Cardinals, because they didn't have Kyler Murray for most of last season, this is the first time for he and Jonathan Gannon to go through the entire process, starting in preseason and training camp, well, summer sessions too. But also think about Marvin Harrison and a massive fourth down catch. He's becoming extremely reliable, as we knew he would. His genes, his preparation, of course, his time in school. I think this win is humongous for the Cardinals. Even if they don't end up with a winning record this season, even if they don't end up making the playoffs, this is one they can hold up and say, look, we did that. We can do this. This is what we aspire to do and where we aspire to be. And right now, both those teams have 2-3 records in the West. And so that means the Seahawks are the only team in the division with a winning record, though they lost to the Giants. Actually, they've lost back-to-back games, but they lost to the Giants on Sunday. Yeah, the NFC West is not in any way a division that packs a punch right now, though there is a long way to go. All right, coming up, man, we really need to put on our racing shoes. I prefer ASICS gel myself when I'm out there racing. There's so much that we need to get to. I'm trying to decide what I want to do on the back end. So just coming off of that game between the Cardinals and the Niners, why don't we do AFC West and talk Raiders and Broncos and then see where we can springboard. Probably Bills and Texans top of the hour. We've got to get to that shootout between the Bengals and the Ravens next hour, too. What did Cincinnati quarterback Joe Burrow tell us? I've got to play damn near perfect in order to beat the Ravens. Oh, man, this was one hell of a game between the two QBs, but also lots of twists and turns and backs and forth, as it usually is the case when those two teams get on the field. 855-212-4227 at A-Law Radio. Our Facebook page, too, will have your Monday MVP poll up very shortly. Here's our latest sports update, and here's Peter Schwartz.
Infinity Sports Network. Sports Flash.
We lead off with Major League Baseball's postseason.
Payoff pitch, and Bogart swings, sends one in the air to deep left field. He might have just hit another. Hernandez is back at the wall. This one is going to go. Xander Bogaerts, bad leg and all. It's the fourth of the night for the Padres. They go back-to-back in the eighth, and it's 7-1.
Jesse Agler on Padres Radio. The Padres beat the Dodgers 10-2. The series tied at a game apiece. Fernando Tatis Jr. with two of the Padres' six home runs. Yu Darvish allowed a run and three hits over seven innings. Game 3 Tuesday in San Diego. In Philadelphia, Nick Castellanos delivered a walk-off RBI single in the bottom of the ninth to give the Phillies a 7-6 win over the Mets. That series tied at a game apiece. Game 3 Tuesday in New York. Now to Sunday Night Football. The Steelers were leading the Cowboys 17-13 late in the fourth quarter.
For the ball game, fourth and goal. Prescott in the gun, snap is back. He has some time. He throws it in the end zone. It's a touchdown to Jalen Tolbert on the left side of the end zone, crossing in front of Deshaun Elliott with 20 seconds to play. Goodness gracious me.
Brad Cham on Cowboys Radio. The Cowboys beat the Steelers 20-17. Elsewhere on the scoreboard, the Giants over the Seahawks 29-20. The Packers beat the Rams 24-19. Cardinals 24, Niners 23. Broncos over the Raiders 34-18. Commanders 34, Browns 13. Dolphins over the Patriots 15-10. Jaguars 37, Colts 34. The Texans over the Bills 23-20. In overtime, the Ravens beat the Bengals 41-38. Bears 36, Panthers 10. And in London, the Vikings over the Jets 23-17. WNBA semifinals, game 4, the Sun over the Lynx 92-82. That series tied at 2. Liberty over the Aces 76-62. New York wins the series 3-1. They're going back to the finals. I'm Peter Schwartz.
Hey, like us on Facebook. Our handle is INF Sportsnet. That's INF Sportsnet for our Facebook page. This is the Infinity Sports Network.
At the Denver 5. Minshew under center. Minshew with a play fake, rolling to his left. Now floats one too high. It's going to be intercepted at the goal line. Down the west sideline, intercepted. This is past Surtain. Sertan's going to house call it. 25-20, 15-10, 5, touchdown.
Off the field, on the money, and after hours, it's time to talk football with Amy Lawrence.
Early in the second round of games on Sunday afternoon, man, there were some brilliant defensive plays. You know, defense wins championships, right? It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Patrick Surtain, he's not only a high-profile Denver Bronco, but he's also one of the highest paid in the NFL, one of the highest paid non-quarterbacks in the NFL. And boy, did he earn his keep in their game against the Raiders. So in division on Sunday, it's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Yeah, right before Patrick Surtain picks off Gardner Minshew and goes 100 yards for a pick six, we also had a 101-yard defensive touchdown, which was awesome to see. So it was the Giants, and the Giants end up beating the Seahawks, but it's the Giants who are maybe a half inch from getting across the goal line on their opening drive against the Seahawks, only to lose the ball and see it get picked up by Rayshon Jenkins and go 101 yards for Seattle the other direction. And of course, there were other pick sixes. Andrew Van Ginkle picked off Aaron Rodgers in London and had a pick six. We talked about Jordan Love's first career pick six by the Los Angeles Rams. So there were others. I felt like defense was really shining brightly, but the Broncos needed every bit of that from their high profile veteran, really one of the only holdouts. Actually, it's better if I call it a holdover from previous eras in Denver, right? They've changed so much. So many of their guys have been traded away or have left. But what they get from Patrick Surtain is something they were willing to pay for. They haven't been willing to pay for a lot of what they've lost, right? Different guys, they've traded them away. And of course, they're eating a lot of the Russell Wilson contract. But when Pat Surtain signed his contract extension, making him the highest paid cornerback in NFL history at the time, right? Coach Sean Payton was talking about wanting to see more from his superstar, wanted to see more from this guy that they've invested so much money in, and one of the veterans in their locker room, and they get that touchdown interception for 100 yards. And yeah, it was a big moment in the game from both the Broncos and the Raiders perspectives.
That situation there, I had to capitalize on that moment and make a play. And I could just feel the momentum shift, you know. You could tell by the team that playing so far, moving forward, we really, really felt the tempo, felt the urgency to really, like, up the energy and up the play for real.
You felt the momentum. I think we all did. But, you know, you kept playing. You keep playing. We come in here at halftime. It's 10-13. You know, felt good about what we was going to do at halftime going forward. And at the end of the day, you know, between penalties and turnovers, we hurt ourselves today.
Antonio Pierce agreeing with Surtain about how it was a critical moment in this game. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Came in the second quarter. And you know, it's not a good thing when the high point of your game is your very first drive. But that's what it was for Gardner Minshew. Made a really sweet moment, a 57-yard touchdown pass to Brock Bowers. That was the first couple minutes of this game in Denver, which kind of knocks the fans back a little bit. But they rallied on that pick six. And also, the second Surtain interception off Minshew is the one that got him benched in favor of Aiden O'Connell. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Denver was already up by 10 points middle of the third quarter because they were really relying on their rookie quarterback to make smart decisions. And on this day, he did.
Third down and goal, a football length inside the five.
41.
Sutton outside of Trotman, wide right. Reynolds split left. Nix throws a route caught by Jaleel McLaughlin, and McLaughlin into the end zone for a Denver touchdown. Broncos looking to blow this thing wide open. Jaleel McLaughlin, the lone back behind Bo Nix under center. Play fake for Bo. Sets in the pocket. Throws a ball to the end zone. Penalty flag thrown. Catch by Josh Reynolds. Touchdown, Denver.
Oh. It was probably the best game of the year for the rookie QB. 19 of 27, couple hundred yards passing, and also ends up with a rushing touchdown. The Broncos as a whole, though, go 3 of 4 in the red zone. There's plenty of room for improvement. They had a pretty poor third down conversion rate, but that defense is terrific against the Raiders. 3 takeaways, so another interception off Aiden O'Connell. A handful of sacks in there as well, and Denver is able to end the 8-game skid against Vegas, which of course goes back to before they were in Las Vegas. And Sean Payton, one of the things that he wants to do as head coach of the Broncos is to protect their home turf.
We've got to capitalize on playing well here. And so that was one of the things we discussed. The Raider thing or whatever, not so much, but we understand it's a division game and it was an important game for us.
Right now, the Broncos are sitting at 3-2. And so if you're wondering about the AFC West, and of course teams are still looking up at the Kansas City Chiefs, they are right behind the Chiefs in those division standings. And still to come on Monday night, we've got the Chiefs who are hosting the Saints. So we'll see whether or not the Chiefs can join the Vikings, who we need to get to, at 5-0. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence. Every now and then we like to throw a wrinkle into our Monday MVP and include a defensive player, Patrick Surtain, because he's earning his keep there in Broncos throwback unis. Did you see them? Kind of throwing back to the days when they used to be a relevant team and used to make playoffs. These are some of my favorite uniforms. I love the bright orange. Champ Bailey was in the house on Sunday there in Denver, and so they kind of did a lot of throwback stuff. We're talking about going back to the 80s and 90s, which is really neat. Speaking of Champ Bailey, right now, tentatively, he is scheduled to be our guest on Tuesday. He's busy since he made the Hall of Fame. It would be really neat to catch up with him after this scene in Denver. So again, Broncos move to 3-2. Raiders fall to 2-3. At this point, we don't know what they'll do at quarterback moving forward. But Gardner Minshew, he had that tremendous game in Baltimore where he led them from 10 points down in the fourth quarter, but otherwise been kind of messy in the last couple of weeks. And of course the Raiders, they've fallen below 500. It doesn't help that Davante Adams is not playing, so he was out again with the hamstring on Sunday, but I don't know that they play him again. Well, if they want to trade him, they need him to be healthy, and he's expressed his desire to leave that Vegas organization, and so we wait to see if an Adams trade materializes in the next couple days. It's After Hours with Amy Lawrence.